This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and as we move to the new year, we're taking a moment to look back at some of the highlights of this show in the past year, and we continue our look back series today with another member of the State of Things staff who usually sits on the other side of the glass. Producer Charlie Shelton is with me in the studio. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Frank. How's it going?
The worm has turned.
This is such a treat because I listen to your show all the time, so this is such a treat.
Well, it's nice to see you face to face. It's nice to put Charlie, how many people have you condemned to sit in that very chair as guests, and now there you are?
I know.
Well, we're looking back this year, and you've produced some fine segments for us. Tell us what you want us to hear first.
Sure. I want to spend the bulk of this first portion of our conversation listening to a Monday meet with folklorist Bill Ferris. We talked to Bill recently here, and he's a professor at UNC Chapel Hill, but more importantly, he is a folklorist at heart, and Bill is really well known as one of the leading documentarians of the South. He's conducted thousands of interviews. He's talked to some amazing people that, you know, if I had talked to like B.B. King, or if I had talked to, you know, Alex Haley or Eudora Welty, all these incredible people who are really, you know, epitomes of the American South, I would be a little bit more boastful as a person. But Bill Ferris, he's super humble. He's a very warm gentleman. He's a great, great person. I loved hearing his story. And what's really important to Bill is his sort of sense of place, and that is the South. But more specifically, he talks about, in the segment that we'll hear, about his home in rural Mississippi. He grew up on a farm. And so what he talks about is what that sort of meant to him growing up in not only the rural atmosphere of Mississippi, but also around several black communities. And that was really sort of a guiding focus to his work as a documentarian. He wanted to record black folklore along with white rural narratives as well. But this piece is really interesting because we sort of hear about the origins of his sense of place, and he speaks so humbly about his life on the farm and the people that he meets along the way. One of them is Mary Gordon, who we'll hear in the segment. She was an older black woman who was Bill's babysitter, who took him to the black churches in Mississippi, and it had a huge impact on him. And we hear from Bill about going to those black churches, and we also hear a clip from Mary Gordon as well. So it's a really, really nice piece.
All right, well, let us listen to this part of a conversation with Bill Ferris.
It was a very isolated world, 15 miles outside of Vicksburg on a gravel road, and this was the end of the road before it left the county, and the families had lived there. They were all black families on the farm, and they were like an extended family. The children were my best friends when I was growing up. The stories that circulated within the community, the little church, Rose Hill Church, where I first went when I was 4 or 5 years old with a wonderful lady named Mary Gordon, those were the memories that really shaped me as a person and started me in a course of travel to understand those worlds.
Tell me more about those church services with Mary Gordon.
Well, I was really going more to as a form of babysitting. She was taking me away from my parents, which they were happy to have, every first Sunday. And it was a church in which there were no hymnals. All the hymns were sung from memory. And they were sung a cappella, so the church would fill with these voices. And then the preaching of the sermon would be this unbelievably powerful sermon with music interrupting it. And that really kind of shaped my earliest awareness of music. And I learned those hymns. I could sing along. So it was forming and educating me in ways that I didn't fully understand, but I still resonate to today.
Did you also have experience? Did you go to the white church, or were you there every Sunday?
I did. This was only on the first Sunday, but my parents attended. They were not really seriously religious, but as part of the culture, they went to a Presbyterian church. And that was much more formal, and it was not a service that touched me in the way that the Rose Hill service did.
I wonder how you felt as a young man going to that church, Rose Hill, the black church in your community in rural Mississippi. You know, how you felt being an outsider. Were you the only or one of very few white people at that service?
I was the only one as a child. I felt very much at home because I knew all the people. Mm. They were people that I grew up with on the farm, and the minister, Reverend Isaac Thomas, lived in Vicksburg, and this was one of four churches that he was part of, and each week in the month he would go to a different church, and Rose Hill was the first Sunday. But other than Reverend Thomas, most of the people in the church I knew really very well from childhood. I knew their names, their families, and they were very generous in accepting me as a part of that community in the church.
Eventually, you did document Rose Hill Church and that community and the stories of Mary Gordon. Was this one of your first projects or one of the first places you thought about as you moved into folklore?
It was. It was sort of like the camera. I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew that I wanted to record and photograph these services because I realized, because there were no hymnals, that when the families were no longer there, that the music would disappear. And I felt an urgency to record those hymns, and without knowing why or if it was of any value, it was simply a personal decision that I made.
Eventually, you did interview Mary Gordon. We have her here singing a song that I'm sure she didn't sing in church, You Shall Be Free, but it certainly is part of the tradition and was abroad in her community at that time. Let's listen to Mary Gordon, You Shall Be Free.
Our Father, who art in heaven, the preacher opened me $10 and paid me $7. The kingdom come, I will be done. If I hadn't took the $7, I wouldn't have gotten none. I had to fight about my money. What he owed me, you shall be free. Some people say that a preacher wouldn't steal. I caught about $7 in my wall milk for you. Cutting and slicing and tearing up my vine. Save my vine, brother, you shall be free. Save the rinds, you shall be free. Don't rob me, you shall be free. Oh, when the good Lord set you free. When I first moved to Memphis, Tennessee, went out on my front porch walking around. I invite the preacher over to my house. Washed his face, combed his head. Next thing he wanted to do, slip in my bed. I caught him by the head, man, kicked him out the door. Don't lie, no preacher around my house no more. Don't like him, you shall be free. They'll rob you, you shall be free. Steal your daughter, you shall be free. Take your wife from me, you shall be free. Oh, when the good Lord set you free. That's just an old thing, you know, it's not true. That ain't no church hymn. It's just something I hear somebody else singing and picked it up.
You Shall Be Free, an interview with Mary Gordon, that interview done by folklorist Bill Ferris in the 1960s. Tell us more about that. I mean, when did you decide that it was important to collect these as a collection, as something that you wanted to preserve?
Well, when I was at Davidson College, I stumbled on a set of recordings that John and Alan Lomax had done for the Library of Congress. And a light went off in my head because I knew the Library of Congress was important, and these Lomax recordings were very important. And I felt like someone had been there ahead of me and legitimize the work that I instinctively was trying to do.
That is a clip from an interview with folklorist Bill Ferris that originally aired not long ago in early December. I'm here today with producer Charlie Shelton looking back at some of his favorites from the year this past year. What stood out to you? And getting to know Bill Ferris, I mean, this is an interesting thing because you are yourself a child of the South and you're getting to interview these folks and find out more. Is it revealing for you to be able to sort of talk to people like Bill Ferris to learn more about the place where you grew up? You should know a lot about it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I'm an interesting case because my whole family is from the North, but I was born in the South and I grew up in the South. So I think the South is an onion that, you know, has so many layers to it. And I mean, I grew up in the South with a Northern family. So I kind of developed my own sense of what the South was and didn't really have that family history behind it. And I only, you know, really knew what was within my own sort of perspective. And so hearing about Bill's life and also cataloging, you know, his work that he's done has been very revealing for me. And it's just pretty impressive. And also, I mean, it's pretty striking to look back at the documentaries that he did and the voices that he recorded, mainly, you know, from the 60s and 70s. And up until today, I mean, all these different voices that he's tried to preserve, coming from, you know, on the top level, blues musicians to, you know, backcountry woods and roads and in the rural South. I mean, it's a huge spectrum that was really, really revealing.
You know, you made this little joke at the top, you know, this this sort of faux starstruck by being on the thing, but you're just a kid. You're fresh out of college. Yeah. You're having to now pre-interview and talk with people, accomplished people with reputations like Bill Ferris and others who we talk to on the show. What's that like for you? I mean, when you get these people on the phone who really have reputations, they've been around for a while and you're fresh out of college. How do you feel?
Absolutely. I am a kid. Thank you, Frank. My biggest fear right now is not letting my voice crack. So I'm really, you know, keep me in check here. But it is, I mean, Bill and I mean, he's 73 years old and he's had this huge accomplishment and I'm just starting out. I'm on the road. So it's been sort of a guiding principle for me as I move forward to mimic Bill in his sort of attitude and also his compassion and his determination for the work that he does. I mean, I'm really interested in the work that he does do, you know, documenting voices of the South and of the larger world, which I think we do very well in the State of Things. So it was really impressive.
Charlie the Kid Shelton, my guest today on the State of Things. We're talking about his favorites, and we'll talk more on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Do stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, spending an hour with State of Things producer Charlie Shelton, looking back at the past year and talking about some of the highlights for you in particular. Charlie, we just heard from Bill Ferris. We did a part of our Monday Meet series, and he talked about the influence of his sense of place in the South and the importance of the oral tradition. You pulled a clip from another meet, this time Rhiannon Giddens of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, of course, now doing a solo career of her own. Why did you choose this piece?
Yeah, well, this was first and foremost, I was so fortunate to talk to Rhiannon Giddens. Huge fan. Got to get that out. Super starstruck. It was awesome. But she was, again, a really, really nice person to talk with and get to know her story. And I chose both Bill's piece and Rhiannon's piece because I think there's just really important link there between Bill's work, you know, focusing on the oral tradition. And he wanted to preserve these stories in order to pass them down to the next generation, which, I mean, you know, might defeat the purpose of the oral tradition, just sort of like passing it down, like,
yeah,
within your community.
That's what the oral tradition is all
about. but anyways, he's preserving these voices for the sake of the oral tradition. And I see Rhiannon Giddens as sort of the epitome of this oral tradition in a lot of really powerful ways because she played with the Carolina Chocolate Drops, which is an old-time roots band, all African-American musicians who were sort of proteges of the fiddler Joe Thompson, who taught them a lot about old-time black roots. And with this clip, Rhiannon talks about what she knew about the banjo at first. You know, she said she didn't really know anything and she learned about that history and the legacy of the banjo. And she speaks about learning of its black roots and how she sort of formed her own musical identity around that instrument, which is really a powerful thing to hear. She kind of chronicles the history of the banjo in a very passionate way. You can tell she's so passionate about it because it is so integral to her own identity, all the while with sort of the ambiance of she is sort of carrying the torch of old-time black roots at the same time. So
here's Rhiannon Giddens.
I knew what everybody knows. It's, you know, it's a hillbilly instrument and hee-haw and all that. So I used to watch hee-haw growing up, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered the old-time, you know, rather than the bluegrass, which, I appreciated bluegrass banjo, but hearing the old time, that claw hammer sound, that really plunky kind of thing, I just fell in love with that first. And then I started you know, I got Cece Conway's book, African Echoes in Appalachia, African Banjo Echoes in Appalachia, and started learning the history of the banjo and then getting recordings of old black string bands, and just kind of like my mind was blown. And then it just like, then it was like on, you know. I loved it. I knew that the music drew me, and some sort of ineffable quality of the banjo drew me. And then when I knew the history, I was, you know, because before then I kind of felt like an interloper, you know. I was like, hi, can I join your jam? You know, it's not really my music, but I really like it. But, you know, then I was like, ow, it is my music. It's everybody's music, you know. And that was a huge, you know, kind of like opening for me. I was just like, my world is opened now. It's amazing.
Well, that's, and that's what gets confusing for folks, because we'll, and I think we'll talk a little bit about the history for those who don't, you know kind of what we're talking about yet, the roots of the banjo, how it got lost, and then how it got recovered. But once you lose it, once it, because it's an instrument that came here from Africa and was associated with African music and African-American culture pre-emancipation, it gets lost, and I'll let you tell more of the story. But then you have to retell the story, so it is everybody's music. In the end, it's everybody's, but we do need to bring the story back, and that means a particular telling of the story from a particular point of view.
No, we do. I mean, you know, because you have, banjo ancestors, like, you know, West African instruments that would have come over. It is an American instrument, because the banjo, as we know it, is formed in America, but it is absolutely attached to the African American experience, because first 100 years of its existence, it was known as a plantation instrument. It was not played by the white community at all, that we know of, you know, other than maybe isolated incidents that we don't know of. But it was only until, you know, the 1840s and 50s that really it took off amongst white entertainers, and then minstrelsy, as we know it, was born. And well, it was, you know, that comes a little earlier, but as we think of it, you know, with banjos and fiddle and tambourine and all that stuff. And that is really the heart of the birth of American entertainment, music, dance. I mean, it's huge. And you know, minstrelsy is the most popular form of entertainment for over like 80 years or something like that. It's insane how big a part it plays in the creation of the American identity, how big a part it plays in the creation of the American identity in the eyes of the world, because it was the first American cultural export, you know, 100 years before rock and roll. I mean, that's the first American music that the rest of the world heard was minstrel music with banjo, you know? And it's just like, the fact that that was such a huge part of our history, and the fact that it's so little known, and that it's has such a small, tiny presence in sort of our overall picture of what American music is, just boggles my mind. And it's just, sorry, you can tell I get really passionate about it.
No, and you should. And the fact that it was it performed as stereotype and as caricature is part of the reason that it fell out of favor among African Americans at that point. Am I right about that?
Well, there's that. You know, you have the Great Migration, you know, and you have new forms of music coming. What we've kind of lost, you know, in our dialogue about black music is we go from spirituals and work songs, and then we skip ahead to, you know, the jazz and blues, you know? And it's like there was this huge time period where you had black minstrels, you know, because the only job in entertainment you could get it was as a minstrel. So you had black people blacking up to be caricatures of themselves, you know, but then subverting it in lots of ways, and how that, you know, was at the heart of the creation of black entertainment. And you can still see that today. I mean, it's just, you know, it's very, very complicated. It wasn't just because of that the banjo fell out of favor. It was, you know, there's the music was moving on. It was, you know, new instruments were coming in, taking the place. You know, it's really complicated. But what is really important is who's writing the history here, and who's writing the music history, and how, you know, my issue is not so much that it fell out of favor in the black community, but that the history and the knowledge of it completely disappeared. And that distresses me, because, you know, we really need to know, everybody needs to know that, but we really need to know it too, you know, that this is like the fact that we have, that the Carolina Chaga Drops has been in existence for 10 years, and we've never gotten a major black publication, an interview in a magazine, you know, anything other than Tavis Smiley, and that was problematic because of his ignorance of the music. You know, the fact that that hasn't happened, you know, I'm just starting to get interest now as a solo artist, you know, from that realm. you know, is troubling to me, and it's always been troubling to all of us, you know, in the Carolina Chocolate Drops.
That was a clip from a discussion back in September with musician Rhiannon Giddens of the Carolina Chocolate Drops and talking with producer Charlie Shelton, who chose that among his top picks looking back at the year 2015. What's next, Charlie?
Next is a clip from our regular segment, Culture 360. And I think this is a really special segment that we do about once a month. And I've really enjoyed being a part of it, because I kind of see this as a very rare opportunity to take cultural news and unpack them in terms of their societal significance. And to do that on sort of a local public radio platform has been really, really unique and really special. So I'll just set up this clip really quickly. We have both of our regular guests, Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown, who are both great and come on our show. And they're talking about Serena Williams in this clip. And she just recently, I think, lost the game leading up to getting the Grand Slam. And the conversation focuses around how she's criticized both as a black woman and as a black woman athlete. And we reference Margo Jefferson and Clifton Wharton in this clip, who are both sort of older black innovators in a different sense of the word than Serena Williams in terms of her athletics. But what this clip does, I think, is a great job of tying in the story of Serena with this next generation. And I think that's what sort of Culture 360 is great at its core, is taking all these different sort of topics in the show, but then sort of having an overarching theme that ties them all together. So
let's listen to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal.
You know, I keep wishing that BET or TV One would start covering tennis. Get to the point that when you watch Serena play, you have to turn off the sound and just watch her play. Because if you were to listen to the commentators about what they were watching, you wouldn't think that you were actually watching what they were talking about. And that speaks to a broader issue in terms of Serena and Venus in particular. What does it mean to have black athletes at the highest level, right? She is GOAT. She is greatest of all time, right? What does it mean to have her perform at that level? And she's never had a situation when she's been on television and there's been someone who was not white commentating on her body and her play and her style and her attitude. I mean, that's significant. When you hear black commentary about Serena, it's largely in the cultural realm. But when you're talking about her as an athlete, as a tennis player, narrating, telling the story of these matches that we're watching, there's nothing but a white gaze there.
That's right.
Well, and I think you make a point that white athletes, while athletes in general may be held to a higher standard, white athletes are never held to their cultural standard or measured against a cultural type.
Every time someone mentions something about, you know, how Serena acts, it's like, you know, go find some video footage of Ilie Nastase, right? Even as you're listening to John McEnroe, go pull up some stuff of John McEnroe, right? But of course, it's that way in which white male privilege, particularly in elite sports, you know, there's a privilege that allows them to act out in a certain kind of way as being part of the package of being who they are.
Well, and nobody said John McEnroe is a typical white guy. That's just how they all are, right? Kind of thing. But also, and Serena was also, I think, pretty valiant in defending her body type, which again gets attacked now and then. And she just stood up and said, look, here's who I am.
It's me, and I love me, and I learned to love me. And I've been like this my whole life, and I embrace me, and I love how I look. I love that I am a full woman, and I'm strong, and I'm powerful, and I'm beautiful at the same time. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Serena Williams, that was on Good Morning America. So this also gets to this question, and you mentioned it a minute ago, Mark, the new memoirs, Margo Jefferson and Clifton Wharton, talking about black elite growing up in a generation before what we call the Civil Rights Movement. What do you make of these two memoirs coming out now?
I think on some levels, it's the only opportunity for them to tell these stories at this point in time, right? Mm-hmm. This is a forgotten history. Like, folks don't know about, you know, particularly this younger generation, the Black Lives Matter generation. They don't know anything about this generation of black elites that emerged before the Civil Rights Movement. You know, the folks who were Jack and Jill, right? Mm-hmm. You know, back in the day. I mean, I think that's an incredible part of our history, in that you had generations of folks in which their parents were very clear about what the racial limits were in society, but told their children, you're going to achieve above and beyond this regardless. And literally, there's no spaces in the culture for them to be able to do that yet, right? You know, integrated college campuses don't really exist the same way. For them to have that kind of faith in what their children were going to achieve, right, and to do it on the highest levels at that period of time, I mean, that's an important story to tell at at this particular historical moment, I think.
Yeah, and I want to go back to Serena because I think that part of the danger of a Serena Williams and Venus Williams is Richard Williams in the background, who is of the same generation, I would imagine, as Margot Jefferson and Clifton Wharton. Maybe he's a little younger, but the point is he instills in these girls the same thing that Margot Jefferson and Clifton Wharton, from their memoirs are expressing coming from their parents. And that sort of work ethic, that sort of undaunted belief that I am going to be the greatest, I'm going to surpass, any limitations that are placed on me, I think is a part of what white America has issue with when it comes to Serena Williams, because she's not trying to play into what the expectations are. And I think that we can trace that back to her dad and her mom very solidly.
That's a clip from our regular segment, Culture 360, with pop culture experts, professors Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. That clip originally aired in September, and I am talking with producer Charlie Shelton today on the state of things about your favorites of the year. Culture 360 is a new segment that we put together mostly after talking with Natalie and Mark on separate occasions, having them together, realizing that they're really smart. They know a lot about pop culture from an African-American perspective. And here's an example of what the state of things does, which is to say, look, these are really two smart people who sound great on the radio. How do we create a vehicle for them to come on the show regularly? And we're doing it. And really, it's a work in progress in a lot of ways. And I just wonder what it's like for you as the producer assigned to make this thing happen. I mean, generally speaking, it's about pop culture from the point of view, from an African-American perspective. We're all we're all privy to pop culture. We all consume it. Now let's hear about it from a different point of view. I mean, in many ways, we're creating this out of whole cloth. What's it like for you as a producer to have to think about things in that way?
It's really interesting because, as a producer, you sort of orchestrate what the segment is and what you're going to talk about and sort of the foundation of it. But for me, I am a white man, and so we're talking about perspectives and opinions and observations that are completely outside of my immediate perspective in my life. And so I think the show has been really fortunate to bring in Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown to provide these perspectives. And it's a regular segment, so we do it every month, and so I think it has its core structure that it really works on a lot of really great ways. But I also have loved seeing how the show evolves in terms of our discussion and the topics that we cover. So I'm looking forward to what happens with it in the future.
Well, staying in the cultural realm, but we'll switch gears a little bit. Your next piece is comedian John Hodgman. Tell us more about that one.
John Hodgman, probably most well known for he's the Mac guy. No, he's a PC guy. He's a PC guy. Mm-hmm. On the Mac versus PC old commercials. Yeah. And he was also a correspondent on The Daily Show. John Hodgman came out of the gate just making us all laugh. Made me crying in the control room. I mean, and he even got to you, Frank. I mean, yeah, in the clip that we're gonna hear, you're in the background giggling. There's a spoiler alert. But he's really an interesting character, and this was one of the most fun I've had with a segment because he is sort of self-deprecating in some ways, and it's easy, I think, for comedians to sort of fall into that schlub self-deprecating character. But in the end, Hodgman is too witty for that, and he just sort of speaks about his identity as a 44-year-old weird mustachioed dad. In a very sort
I'm
of,
laughing again.
In a very
and you're
complex,
saying it.
I know. I'm trying not to lose it, but it's a complex and nuanced sort of thought process, which I thought was hilarious and really unique.
John Hodgman.
In 2005, 10 years ago, I brought out a book of fake trivia and invented amazing true facts called The Areas of My Expertise. And I promoted it on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And a couple months later, in January of 2006, he asked me back to be a contributor to the show. And only a couple months after that, I was asked to audition for these ads, and I got them. And suddenly, in my then mid-30s, I went from being a professional writer, which is to say someone who rarely put on clothes and certainly did not need to look good on camera, to this weird round-faced man baby with a lazy eye who should not be on-camera talent, and yet I've managed to stay with it ever since.
Well, had that been a goal of yours? Had that been something you wanted to do?
Well, I mean, I love to perform, and I am an incredible ham, and I really love movies and television and that culture as well. But by the time I was in my mid-30s, I figured my chance had long passed for me to do that. And so my one ambition in life was to continue to write made-up facts and fake lists of, say, the nine U.S. presidents who had hooks for hands and that sort of thing. And I ended up getting to write three more books of fake facts and invented truths until I realized that I was out of fake facts. And now, if I wanted to continue to perform live on stage and in person, I would need to come up with something new to do. And what was left to me, unfortunately, was only the loathsome truth that I'm now a 44-year-old man, as you say, with a mustache that sends an evolutionary signal to the world that I'm all done or nearly done. It lets the mating pool know that I have passed on my genetic material. So no thank you to physical affection. It's time for me to focus on learning World War II trivia and crying at commercials and other weird dad hobbies like that.
Which brings us to Vacation Land. Tell us about that show.
Yeah. Well, so Vacation Land is my second big one-man show of monologues that are basically personal true stories about my life as an actual human being with an actual family and two human children. And we're very lucky in that I have long been marginally self-employed. My wife is a high school teacher, and my children are unemployable deadbeats, basically. So we've had a lot of chance to go away in the summer to the land of my birth, which is New England, specifically rural Western Massachusetts, where my mom had a house. And when she passed away a long time ago, my wife and I took it over. And I'm a city kid, so my encounters with the country, and this is a true countryside. This is not tourist country out there in Western Massachusetts. Dairy farms, and people looking at you funny. And my encounters with the country were hard and weird and ridiculous, including profound anxiety attacks that I would have as I was taking my garbage to the dump, because technically we weren't allowed to dump our garbage at that particular dump. And my 15-year fear that I was going to be called on this and be put in dump jail at any time. I've finally gotten over that. But just after I got over it, we started spending more and more time instead in Maine, which is a place where my wife has family. And Maine, of course, is known as Vacation Land, which is a cruel joke because it is the home of the most painful beaches on earth. And yet people still go there, including us. And a lot of the story is about me making peace, as we all have to, with various life transitions of leaving one career or one place in your life and going to an uncomfortable place, whether that is an uncomfortable new job or an uncomfortable new relationship or a literally uncomfortable place where the beaches are jagged rocks and the water is made of hate.
That was a clip of comedian John Hodgman talking about his entrance into television and recent comedy show Vacation Land. That clip originally aired in October. I'm talking with Charlie Shelton on the state of things about his favorites for 2015, and we'll talk more in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, continuing our series of shows looking back at the past year, listening to some of the favorite segments as chosen by our producers. Today, Charlie Shelton joins us to tell us more about his. What's next, Charlie?
For this next portion, I've picked two music clips. I love music, which sounds like the most cliche thing ever, but
it's the universal language.
It
Charlie.
Is. That's a bumper sticker somewhere. So for this last one, or for the second to last one here, I pulled a clip of two hip hop artists, Kazi and Jay Rowdy. They back in August, they were putting on Hillmatic in Chapel Hill, which was sort of a festival celebrating Chapel Hill hip hop. And this is special to my heart because this was my first segment as a producer on the show. So this was my first real experience of putting all the pieces of the puzzle together and creating a show that turned out really well. And it was really fun. It was just a fun segment to do and to hear happen live in the studio. So what I pulled was the rapper Kazi. He's performing his song Reminisce, and the way he leads up to the song, you know, with what he does as a rapper, but then once you know, the music kicks in, he just like gets live, which is awesome to see, and I really enjoyed it.
All right.
Square one for me is lyricism, you know, and Nas being a big influence on me, KRS-One. Mm. You know, I came up in a different era, you know. Spirit of 94 was my first album, you know, and that was a tribute to the people that influenced me, you know, Snoop, Outkast, Nas, Biggie. Just, you know, I was blessed to open for Nas at the D-Pack two summers ago. That was a dream come true, you know. And so for me, you know, I think that's the part where, you know, when you say a brother that's educated, what's the best way that I can express myself, right, in America At this point, it ain't politics. I can touch the youth through a record. I can say everything I got to say through this music and these records and have it transcend all races, colors, and nationalities all across the world. Right. So that Nick calling it that had everything to do with it. And it's catchy, and it's you know, I like right. it. I think it just sounds cool. You know what I mean? But that had a lot to definitely do with it. It's a salute to lyricism and real hip-hop.
Will you do something for us now?
I will. Yeah. What's up, world? It's your boy, Kazi. Yeah. We about to go back. Days like this, sometimes I wish
that I could sit back, reminisce, and
blow the
la la la.
Yeah. Reminisce.
And blow the la la la.
Yeah.
Reminisce.
On days like this, sometimes I wish that I could sit back, reminisce, and blow the la la la.
Reminisce,
yeah.
And blow the la la la.
Listen, yo. I remember Dale City days and them Chapel Hill nights. Richland Sundays and Friday night lights. Girlfriends, boyfriends, and hallway fights. When the license plate still said first in flight. I used to chase the ice cream man up the street. The concrete was burning me with no shoes on my feet. My mama in the kitchen chefing up something to eat. We diving on the slip and slide cause the weather's so sweet. Family reunions with pops on the grill. Coleslaw, hush puppies finalize the meal. Cousins I ain't seen, but we all keep it real. We ain't old enough to drink, so we gotta sneak and steal. Dale City, VA, I repped it on the map, but every summer I was back in the CAC. Riding bikes, running across my Uncle Backo Patch. Drinking Auntie Kool-Aid, brother, holla back. Yeah,
days like this, sometimes I wish that I could sit back, reminisce, and blow the la la la.
Come on,
and blow the la la la.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On days like this, sometimes I wish that I could sit back, reminisce, and blow the la la la.
What's up, world? Yeah. Now I'm down in the town of the perfect water, making rap songs with my cousin Axe Slaughter. Cutting up, shooting ball outside with my cousins. In the summer heat, cracking jokes, just bugging. My mama tired of yelling cause we always into something. Pick a, get a app, and it was nothing. And back then I thought that she did it out of spite. But now I gotta thank her cause she tried to raise me right. She told me, do your lesson, my son, don't act no fool. Wake your butt up, it's time to go to Sunday school. And shooting ball up at Phillips on the Sundays, cool. We ain't holding down for my mom, that's Pop Pop's rule. Good grades, so I pay attention when they teach. But prime weekend, we staying at the beach. Rolling in a Mustang, not meaning no harm. Drunk, getting tipsy off a swig of Boone's Farm. My God,
days like this, sometimes I wish that I could woo. Sit back, reminisce,
and blow the la la la. Reminisce, reminisce.
Blow the la la la.
Yeah. Hey,
on days like this, sometimes I wish that I could sit back,
reminisce,
blow the la la la.
Yeah,
and blow the la la la.
Reminisce a whole day away. All right.
Great song.
Thank you, man.
Got a lot of the local element here. You reminded me of Boone's Farm, which I will never forgive you for. But
it's the nostalgia.
It's a great song. But, you know, you said something earlier. You said, I can't reach the kids through politics. Everybody kind of rolled their eyes when we said it. But then once you reach them, if politics is out of reach, if politics is not the venue, that's where the change happens. So right. So what's the point of reaching? Is there a connection? Do you try to make a connection?
I think you do definitely try to make a connection, because when I came up, you know, I'm not saying that to slight the political movement, and I do believe in voting and all these things that matter. But I learned from KRS-One, Chuck D from Public Enemy, Talib Kweli, Mos Def, the issues that aren't going to be talked about on that debate stage.
Right.
It's why Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, some of these movements are taking the precedent they are. People want to turn the volume down on them, but it's always been the hip-hop artists.
That's a clip from a conversation with Kevin Thomas, also known as the rapper Kazi. That happened back in August. Charlie Shelton produced that segment, his very first one. In fact, it is framed now and on top of his cubicle, right there in a frame, this particular segment. Congratulations. It was a great segment, and it was a lot of fun to do. What stood out for you in that conversation? I guess both what happened on the air, but also tell us about setting it up as well.
Sure. So I set it all up the day before that we had it. Sometimes here on the State of Things, we have all the pieces of the puzzle come together the day before. Mm-hmm. Never the day of, but the day before, mm-hmm. you know, it comes together. And so setting that up, you know, you have these two hip-hop artists who have sort of a background as sort of intergenerational. Kazi is a little bit older, and then J. Rowdy was sort of the next generation. And so you want to hear about their different stories getting into the hip-hop scene in Chapel Hill, but then they're also musicians at the end of it, so you want to bring in, you know, who they are as rappers and hear a little bit of their work. So it was great coordinating with them what songs they wanted to play and then also hearing their story. And Kazi was so much fun to talk to in particular. They both were, but Kazi, he has, you know, decades of experience living in Chapel Hill in the area, and hearing him talk about, you know, his experience with the Chapel Hill hip-hop scene, he was one of the longest pre-interviews I've ever done, because he kept me on the phone talking about, you know, how he opened for Nas at Deepak, and it was fantastic to hear sort of him outlining a type of music that I don't think gets enough play in the Triangle, and especially in Chapel Hill. You don't really think of hip-hop in Chapel Hill. So
this is the great grief for producers that I think our listeners don't fully appreciate, is that you do spend a lot of time on the phone and doing some background stuff, all of which ultimately comes to me. It's my job to, you know, sort of assimilate it and be ready when they're on the air, and without you, I couldn't do it, and without all that time. But there's so much that gets left on the floor. So you know there were 30 shows in that, and only one of them can go out. And hopefully it was a great show, so that what people heard was fine. But oh, the sorrow and oh, the grief of what could have happened if only we had 4 hours.
Yeah, someday, you know, I think we're going to make you sit in that chair, Frank, mm-hmm. and bring in the guests, and we're going to do a show with every bit of information that we're just, we had. And that it'll be 12 hours.
Pretty close to my last show, I think. Yeah. More music now. Phil Cook, tell us about this.
Yeah, I picked a song from Phil Cook because Phil Cook is a very talented musician and pretty well known in the area for playing with the band Megaphon, but he released a solo album this year. And this clip was really great. He came into our studio to play for us. And the same day, we had another guest, Reverend Michael Lapsley, on the show. And Reverend Lapsley was a South African liberation activist. And he shared his story about sort of his struggles in that field, but also maintaining such a high spirit throughout his whole life. And Phil Cook was really moved by his story, as we all were. And so when Phil Cook came in, he dedicated his first song to Reverend Lapsley, which I love it when that happens on our show, that, you know, you tie in different segments when they have on the surface nothing to do with each other, but that you can tie them in together. And this was done in a really intimate and really passionate way from Phil Cook. So it was great to hear him dedicate that to Reverend Lapsley.
Let's hear Phil Cook.
I'm going to dedicate this to Father Michael Lapsley, who was just so incredible to sit out there. I was thinking about these songs and being like, okay, don't forget the lyrics, Phil. And then I just was listening to this incredible man speak so eloquently about so many just hard topics. And it's called Take Your Burden to the Lord and Leave It There, an old gospel song. I sing it and dedicate it to him. Thanks. Body suffers pain, and your health you can't regain, and your soul is almost sinking in despair. He will know the pain you feel, he will ride, he will heal, take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. Leave it there, oh, leave it there. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. If you trust and never doubt, I know he'll surely bring you out. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. If you've seen it all go by, and by chance you wonder why, sorrow, pain, and misery are everywhere, he will up your load, put your feet back on the road, take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. Leave it there, oh, leave it there. Take
If you trust him, never doubt, I know he'll surely ring you out. Take your burden to the Lord and lead him.
Phil Cook, take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. You know, there, you talked about Father Michael Lapsley and what he was saying about where we meet and whatever your circumstances, we meet down there at grief that we all share. And I know there's a lot of talk about appropriation, too. Do we dare take, you and I who have never experienced as white men, where this song comes from, the grief that this song came out of. And yet, but there is a way that a song like this speaks to us, and you can take it and make it your own.
I'll tell you what, you know, I grew up in a Presbyterian church in a very, I mean, it was a wonderful community of people that supported me and encouraged me and knew I was a little kid who played piano, and they would get, you know, they all, I received loads of encouragement, and it was wonderful. But the religion part, the faith part of it, didn't really sink in until I was just older and had experienced more adult, just being an adult, the things that you have about the stress of just having a responsibility of having a child, of keeping your marriage going, and losing your immediate family. And, you know, I had two grandparents die while I was making this record. And I don't know, I just found this healing in myself by just singing some of these songs. Yeah. I don't know why. And I don't know why I was a kid that was just some little kid with glasses sitting up in wherever in northern Wisconsin. I think that when music is created, it creates a vibration into the universe. And I think that, you know, what Pop Staples used to say was anything that comes from the heart reaches the heart.
That was a clip from our conversation with Phil Cook, aired in September, one of Charlie Shelton's favorite. Charlie Shelton, a producer on The State of Things. What else about that conversation did you enjoy?
Well, I enjoyed Phil Cook's background because he is a Wisconsinite, and my whole family's from Wisconsin. So making that connection, I always love making the Wisconsin connection. So that was really interesting to make that bond. But also, that's important because Phil Cook is also really well-versed in the blues with sort of American Southern music in general. You know, his album brings in gospel music, bluegrass, blues, all that stuff. So having a conversation with him, we talked a little bit about sort of the adoption of the blues and gospel by a non-Southerner, which I think is an important conversation with which people and musicians do from time to time. But Phil Cook spoke about this topic with an admiration for the blues, which I really respected. And, you know, you could tell that he's, you know, not trying to really adopt the narratives of people that grew up in, you know, Bill Ferris's backyard in rural Mississippi in the 1950s and 60s, you know, but he's just kind of coming in and admiring the music for what it is. And I think that was really special. And I respected him for the work that he's doing and the people that he's collaborating with.
And the great thing about doing this show is the wealth and richness of the musical story here in North Carolina, and the number of musicians and the number of genres that we can bring on the show. So I'm glad you did that. I'm glad you picked that one. We'll go out on that music. But first, I want to thank you, Charlie Shelton, a producer on The State of Things. Thanks very much for a fabulous year, and let's do it again next year, shall we?
Thank you, Frank. We'll be back.
Charlie Shelton, one of the producers on The State of Things, along with Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley's our technical director. Along with Al Wadarski, Brent Wolf is WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow. Once again, the music of Phil Cook.